Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hello, 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 hello. Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening, wherever you are. My name is Alex Q, and welcome to the 5th episode of Miscast. Just grow a pair, rings. just grow a pair.
No words, Alex. No words anymore.
Just grow pairings. This is the 5th episode in our short series where each episode, using the expertise of my superstar co-host and special guest, we will discuss tabletop topics that we hope will help improve your generalship, expertise, and enjoyment of your gaming experience. It's the podcast that will talk nonsense and sense in, well, in an equal measure. And it's a podcast that's been re-watching thriller horror movies from years past, like Silence of the Lambs and American Psycho. Ooh. It's that kind of podcast.
Nice.
Amazing. I love this podcast. I'm a particular fan of this. What's the one? There's like an 80s one, which was the prequel. It's the Red Dragon movie. Have you seen that one?
Oh, the Hannibal prequel one.
Yeah, with the guy from CSI in it.
Oh, yeah. I know the one you think.
That's my fave. Yeah, but I can't think
Over
of
Over Silence of the Lambs. Over Clarice, exactly. I'd forgotten how freaky he is, Anthony Hopkins. For anyone who hasn't seen this film, watch it. It's amazing. I'd forgotten how freaky he is with his eyes. And you know when he walks with his arms down by the side and he doesn't move his arms. If you go back and watch the film, as he's walking around, he never moves his arms and he never blinks.
Like a Thunderbird.
Like David Bowie out of the Labyrinth, just floating about.
Yeah, just floating around like a cannibalistic David Bowie. That's how we're describing Silence of the Lambs.
I can't watch horror films. They scare me. I'm too emotive. Do you know The Grudge? Is it The Grudge with Buffy in it? Was it The Grudge?
Oh, yeah, Sarah Michelle Gellar. Yeah. That's The Grudge. The one where she has the fingers come out of her head.
Yeah, so there's a scene in that where she's in a lift and she's going up in the elevator. It's an American film. So you're going up in the elevator and you can see out the corridor. And it's a very long corridor each time she goes up up a level, you know. And at the right at the end, I tell you what I really can't fucking do, zombie children. Right at the end of this corridor, there's this little zombie child and boom, goes up a level. The zombie child's closer, boom, goes up a level. Zombie child's closer, boom, goes up a level. Zombie child's closer, boom. The zombie child's head is slightly at a tilt right by the glass. And at that point, the kid goes, meow. And I absolutely shit myself in the cinema. I go, almost quiet. And then there's a group of Japanese tourists, I can only assume, right at the back of the cinema screen. And they all go, they all laugh, but very high pitched. So it's like a kind of laugh. Mm. And then then the whole cinema laughs at the Japanese people laughing at me. And it was just like, it was the most surreal. It was the most surreal cinematic experience I've ever had. I felt very, yeah, I can't do zombie. I can't do zombie children. And I can't.
Horror children in general is just, it's just yeah. awful. It's children like the ring. The children ring of as the well.
Corn. That's a good one. Children of the Corn. Have you seen that?
Oh, I haven't seen that. That's not one I've seen.
That's a Stephen King adaptation. That's great. Manhunter, by the way, is the name of the 80s sort of Hannibal Lecter.
Manhunter.
Yes. Yeah. And it's directed by Michael Mann, who did...
Michael Mann! It sounds like a great porn, doesn't it?
I would highly recommend that movie, by the way.
This is for the listeners, the regular listeners, this is not leading into another Darren Knees story. It's fine, so don't worry about it.
No knees were made dirty in the telling of this ramble.
Oh dear. Right. So enough of the horror movie stuff. Right, let's get my first lovely co-host in. You've heard his sexy serenades already. He goes by @PositiveVictim on Twitter. It's Darren Watson. Hi, Darren.
Ooh. Hey, beautiful. You well?
Right.
Me? Yes. Let me tell you about my week, if you've got, I don't know, 20 minutes?
2 hours.
Yeah. 2 hours? Yeah, okay. So today I've had a lovely day, very, very busy day. I've got 3 one-to-ones done today, which is wonderful. I had my first training game on TTS, which went really well, considering how crap I am with technology.
That's Age of Sigma one-to-ones, right?
Yes, they are. And I've had a very busy day. I've got 20 models built, Grimghasts built, and I've also had a full day of doing life insurance. But the news I've got for you is I'm engaged.
Woo! Congratulations.
Thank you very much.
Congrats.
It was done in a very atypical Darren way, Alex describes it as. in so much as I didn't know I was going to do it. It was entirely spontaneous. And I've done it. I didn't have a ring. I hadn't asked the father's permission. We'd just spent the day together and the evening together. And I'd spent the entire evening just in awe of my girlfriend, Alex. We went to, it was my friend Dave's 60th birthday. And we arrived at the pub. There's three chaps that we've never met before. Dave is part of our pub quiz team that we go to in the Bold Forester on Tuesdays. We adopted him, actually. We were playing, and he was on his own, and he leant over and he gave us the right answer to a question. So we said, right, you can be on our team. And he's been on our team every Tuesday for the past 6 months. So we love Dave. Anyway, we arrive at the pub. We get introduced to three of Dave's mates. They're in their 60s, and I need a toilet, so I go to the toilet. And I come back and Alex is in the middle of all these chaps. She's the light and soul. You know, they're all completely engaged with her. You know, and I was just thinking to her, gosh, she's wonderful. She can just meet anyone. She just lights up. She improves every evening. Later on in the evening, we go to the Jolly Sailor and a couple of my friends from Bruce Bowl turn up, one of them being Matt, who she's never met before. And she goes out of her way to sit down with him, make him feel great, you know, spends a good 20, 30 minutes with him, asking him all sorts of lovely questions. He's having a great time. He's not the most confident of people, so you could see he really appreciated the effort that she'd gone to, and she does it effortlessly. She didn't identify him as someone that was, you know, not so good socially. She just does that with everyone. And I was just thinking, God, you're just bloody brilliant. And then this live band that was playing, they were so good. They were so good. They played everything from Oasis to like the Streets. And it was really good. And at the end of Don't Look Back in Anger, Alex turns around to me and we've had a good dance and we've been spinning about. And she says, I love this band. We really need to book them for something. And I was thinking the same thing, but I was thinking, I want to book this band for my wedding. And then I thought, fuck it, I'm just going to ask her. Now,
you didn't even know.
No, I didn't. I didn't know.
Oh, I'm on tenterhooks, Darren. This is like a movie.
Well, the reason I've not asked, I've been with Alex, I'm 12 years older than Alex. So I've always felt like I met her when she was 19 and a half. And then she pursued me for 6 months. Because I always thought that's, you know, I was 31 at the time, then became 32. I always thought this is a bit dodge, but love is love.
or the 18th century.
She woke up on her 20th birthday and went, Darren, you're no longer dating a teenager. And I felt terrible. But yeah, so I've always felt like I don't want to trap her. Marriage is such an important decision. And like I didn't want to ask her when she was younger. I wanted to ask her when she was, oh God, that sounds terrible, doesn't it? Fully capable. Like she is a fully capable woman, and she has been for a long time. I think a lot of it was just in my head. But so in recent years, I've been thinking, right, I want to live, you know, be with this woman forever. But I've always thought, oh, I don't have enough money for this, that, or the other. And it, long story short, in that moment, it just all bubbled out of me. And I just, I said to her, I know who we need to book this band for. We need to book them for our wedding. And then she looked at me very quizzically. She didn't say yes immediately, which really worried me. She went, are you drunk? And I was like, no, I'm not drunk. I'm not drunk. And she went, because if you are, that's a terrible time to ask me. And I was like, no, I'm not drunk. And then we saw, then the next song came on. And I, in my head, I was having this utter crisis. I was like, oh my God, I fucked up. Like the most, what should be the most sweet, wonderful moment of our, you know, our lives. And I was like, right, keep it together. Just dance as if you're okay. And at the end of the song, she went, so you're definitely not drunk. I said, I'm definitely not drunk. And then her eyes absolutely lit up. You know, when you first go out with someone and they've got twinkly eyes, and that's when all those sort of chemicals and, you know, that the scientific part of love is happening. That fades after 2 years. You no longer have those chemicals, because, you know, as I understand it, because that's the amount of time it takes to meet someone, have a baby and raise them, you know. And for me, the magic of love is when that fades, you still have something special. And it's the first time I'd seen, like, Alex's eyes twinkle like they had when we first met. It was really cool. And then she said, yes, of course I will. And then since then, she's just been, she walks around the house singing, fiancé, fiancé. Fiance.
You know. Oh, Darren, you are.
Oh, it's just, it was brilliant.
Nah, man, you are a good, you're a good soul. I don't want to talk about toy soldiers anymore. I just want to hear about your relationship.
Yeah, genuinely, that was great. That was awesome. And we did say when we started this podcast, we wanted people to feel good. And what that is a feel good moment right there. Yeah, so, yeah, well, congratulations, Darren.
Congratulations, Darren. Really good.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
But enough of that romantic stuff, because your first love was Sigma, right?
Well, it was fantasy, Warhammer fantasy, definitely. But
just quickly before we go on to Owen, if we have to, how is the rest of the Patreon stuff? Is that all right?
We're at capacity now. We've got 30, I think a couple of people left today, actually, which is fine, because when if you're not getting value from something, you should absolutely not be there.
Sure.
But I'm at capacity anyway. We're starting to get some results for some chaps. So some people are starting to win games. What's really exciting me is I'm very, very like when we discuss lists, I'm very like, these are my ideas, but please, I want you to build on them. Like, I don't just want you to copy and paste or take what I'm saying as read. I want you to use the concepts that I'm perhaps introducing to you, and I want you to meld them with your own. And people are coming back with their own lists, and they're starting to get results. I've had some chap that's never gone. He goes to a lot of one-dayers. His best result previously was 2-1, and he's gone 3-0 recently, you know. So it's fucking nerve-wracking thinking that people are spending money to get some results, and then what if they don't get any results? Some people are starting to see some results, and some people are starting to come back with some really cool, well thought out lists. The sort of feedback I'm getting is, oh, I really like the fact that I'm not just netlisting. I'm not just searching for the next netlist now. I'm sitting down and I'm considering this, that, and the other. And a couple of people have been doing sort of battle reports for me, you know, and going through it, and they're, you know, it's just really exciting hearing someone's development and understanding, in, you know, clearly increase, you know. So yeah, it's going well. It's exciting. I am enjoying it. I am wondering how much I can actually build from this, because there's surely a point where they don't need me anymore. It's a bad business model, isn't it? But I'm not in it for the money. But yeah, thank you. It's going very well. It's very
awesome. Exciting. Yeah, I've heard some good things. So yeah, that's great. Right. Let us stop chatting, Darren, and get Mr. Sexy Sock Seductor in.
Mm.
You can find him at Sock Me Daddy on the gram. He's at OJ180 on Twitter. It's the Owen Jackson.
The
Hi, Owen.
Hello. Hello, listeners.
You know what's happened, Owen, by the way?
Go on.
We've only gone and reached 500 followers, Owen.
Very, very nice.
I'm very much aware of this fact. Yes, I am. Yes. It's on the pile, you know, with all the other stuff I need to do. But yeah, I'm gonna come up with some bespoke miscast socks for everyone to wear, you know, to high-powered business meetings or when they
the
want
stuff.
To pronounce.
Oh, my one-to-ones. I want to be wearing my one-to-ones.
Or when you propose to your, you know, girlfriend, part boyfriend, you know, like for those special moments, there will be socks for. The only ones I'm really like sort of fixating on is the Realm of Jizzier ones that I want to do. Realm of Jizzier with a
Realm of Jizzier ones. What?
Jazz ear, like Azir, but with jazz in it.
I heard was jizz.
So. No, you've obviously had a great week, and it's on the mind, Darren. So. we'll do that definitely.
Yes, that's right, listeners. We are on it. So yes, socks. So if you want some socks, that now we're going to start doing them. So keep your eyes. Eyes peeled? Ears peeled?
Yeah,
eyes peeled.
Eyes and ears.
Eyes and ears peeled.
Yeah, yeah, photo shoot incoming, eh?
Well, yes, exactly.
Yeah,
exactly. Definitely. And you're off to USA. 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 You're off to USA again.
Yeah, or as, what did Rob call it on his recent tabletop in 10 minutes video? The United States of Yeehaw. I quite like that. So yeah, I'm off there again. But no, I'm good. Yeah, working hard. Lots going on. I mean, it's an Age of Sigmar podcast. And I haven't really been playing a lot of Age of Sigmar. I did go to a tournament and I took my trees again, which was fun.
Did your tech piece seekers again?
Yes, they were fantastic in many games. But fragile. I'm not playing the big bomb that one of the other voices on this podcast is currently playing. But yeah, three. I think of them the Revenant Seekers. Now this is for the Sylvaneth. They're this kind of like backfield sort of. They kind of crab. They only move sideways for the first few turns, and then they can jump forward and do some stuff. But yeah, so I went up to Nottingham, played a tournament. That was fun. Got my poo pushed in by the person who won it with Nighthaunt because they're totally busted. And then I won my other games. I put my notes here. I played David Smith. I want to give him a special shout, actually, from the Irish team. He did tell me that most of the Irish team don't like me because we marked them down for painting at Six Nations. And I think I changed his mind. He's the only person I've kissed in quite a long time, and I kissed him on the cheek on the Saturday night. It was really stubbly, but he was a delight. He won best army and favorite opponent, and we all drank White Claw together and had a lovely time.
Oh my god,
it was amazing. I also played some Stormcast, Eidneth, and I beat Thunder Lizard. Fuck you. Yes, and it was no book battle tactics or grand strategies, so it was a really no battle tome sort of stuff. So it was
just GHB stuff.
Yeah, pure GHB. So it was a good test. I had a really nice time, came second, and that was, in prep for my trip over to see a previous guest, Leo. I'm going to go and fly to Washington on Wednesday. I'm going to go to Nova.
Wonderful.
And Nova, it should be exciting because it's that cool format whereby it's a 2-day.
Oh, it's the end bracket, isn't it? Top 8. And then, I love this format.
Yeah, so we're both going to be trying. But the scoring's interesting because it's a really granular differential. So you either have to 5-0 or get a really cracking.
Yeah, you've got to do
4-1.
Real well, don't you? It's the same as LVO format, isn't it? Just explain for the listener what we're talking about. I've just realised we haven't explained it.
So 200-person event. And at the end of the Sunday, normally when all the, well, I was going to say prizes get given out, but in the UK, all the certificates get given out. At that point, the top eight players then go forward to a, to a Sunday, like knockout top eight. So, so I would imagine it would be, so yeah, the eight best performing players over the course of the 2 days then go forward. And I'd imagine it would be one place eight. Second place played
seven.
And as usual, you know, I'm kind of getting to know the American meta quite well, so lots of Team America and Team Canada, like national players, plus lots of good, you know, local players and players from all over America. So it should be a really competitive event. And Leo played NASCON last week.
With his dragons.
So yeah, it'd be great. Looking forward to that. But there's a battle tome to be finished before then.
Yes.
There's the sound of teeny tiny feet, and I'm not talking about babies. There's something rustling in the undergrowth. So
yes, we will be doing a lovely podcast about what we're talking about, but yeah, we don't necessarily want to mention it just yet.
Beastmasters. Yeah, no. Sorry. I'm okay. Not playing loads.
You're about to play a ton because you're going to get through to Sunday top eight and smash with the Americans.
USA! USA! Yeah, exactly. So I'm great. Thank you. And it's a pleasure to be hanging out with you guys as ever.
Oh, well, lovely to hang out with you as well, Owen. And what a good segue mentioning international superstars because we've got another one as our guest. So he is an international superstar and another GT winner. Basically, everyone we have on is just winners, basically. So don't say we don't get the experts in for you. He makes the crowd go hug it wild. He is the Cilla Black of AOS matchups. It's England's ex-captain. I'm going to say ex-captain. Fantastic. It's at LHWAOS on Twitter. It's Laurie Hug It Wild, everybody.
Evening, everyone. Thanks for having me. Very happy to be here.
Hi, Laurie.
That's the done that joke with my surname as well, Alex. That's really inspired.
I can't tell if you're being sarcastic or not, but I hope it's...
What's the Cilla Black reference?
Not Cilla Black. Hug It Wild. Wild.
Hug It Wild, Darren, not the Cilla Black. Cilla Black is blind date because it's matchups.
Didn't you mention Cilla Black?
Yeah, I did. Yeah, he makes the crowd go Hug It Wild was the first one.
Yeah, and I got that.
And then Cilla Black of AOS matchups because she did blind date, didn't she? Do you know, Darren, a joke is always better when you have to explain it over and over and over again.
I did it for a minute or so, yeah.
Wow.
Anyway, Laurie, all good. How are you doing, sir? All fun? How's Sigmar? You were telling us about your hectic life before we started recording.
I've got a little 3-month baby, which is, you know, exactly what you expected it. But I'm currently sat next to a pile of 21 dice, which I keep on rolling to see how much damage my Gossamid archers would do, which is, you know, that's the closest I can get to playing at times. So it works. They just killed a magma drop, actually, just before I came on the podcast. So that's exciting.
I've got a question, Laurie. Is it worth 440 points, though?
But what is, Owen? What is in the...
Oh, we're going philosophical. Yeah. What is worth 800 points in this world? Yeah. So you're silver nothing, aren't you?
I'm very, very much enjoying the new book. Getting lots of games and as many as I can squeeze in, and writing lots of lists. And as Owen mentioned earlier, on the Nine Seeker train, and then it's working out what you take with the rest of it. Hence Gossamid Archers, which, I think are massively overpriced, but maybe they fit. Who knows? Who knows?
Yeah. So if anyone wants to see, do go to see Laurie's Twitter feed. He does post some lovely pictures. And as we mentioned on previous episodes, it's quite useful to see, you know, lots of the top players and how they play and what they use and how they move things. I find it quite useful to see the pictures anyway. But you're using this nine Cecilis. And what are you thinking with the gossamage? You're trying to add something different into it, are you?
This risks straying into a Silverneff podcast. And I actually did on Sunday, there's a Silverneff YouTube video I did with AOS Coach. So if anyone's interested in Silverneff, then this is cross marketing, which I think is the main purpose of this podcast, is to cross market other stuff. And so you've got nine seekers, and they are striking and fading each turn. So they're your thing going forward and striking and fading away. So what do you do with the rest of your army? You can't strike and fade two things in most lists. So do you take six bow hunters, which are definitely overpriced, or do you take 10 Gossamond archers, which are also definitely overpriced, or do you take a Treelord Ancient, which is also definitely overpriced? So that's the conundrum I'm having at the moment. So I don't think two hammers works personally, and so I'm trying to work out how I fill out the final 600 points of my list, basically.
Is the answer to all three of those questions no?
Then what is it, Darren? I should become your Patreon, shouldn't I? One of your
I don't know. If they are genuinely overpriced,
but so this is the question, and it's a good one. Are they? Can something become not overpriced if it just fits what your list needs? They are overpriced in other lists. In my list, are they? Do they actually do the job well enough? Yeah, because
that's something to explore.
I agree with that. I think what I'd love to take actually is 30 dryads, but I think in the world of bounty hunters, they just get decimated too easily.
Mm. I think if you're having list problems, Rory, there is an excellent episode. It's called Episode 4 that we did last time about list building. It's fantastic. Even if I am biased,
it is fantastic. I agree. It was a very
good chat. List problems up or bad for you, son. I got 99 problems. List building ain't one. Hit me.
Very good.
Yeah, that's what I should have done as the intro. Yeah, although it has resulted in me getting a lot of hex wraiths now, which has got nothing to do with Simon Weekly at all whatsoever.
You monster.
Great. I know, I am a monster. It's glorious. Right, enough of that stuff. Shall we get into it? So, people have messaged me about clocks. do we want to do it? Do you want to talk about clocks? Do you want to do this episode?
No.
So we're not going to do it. We will do it in an episode, though, I promise. We will do it. But this episode, if you didn't get my amazing title, we are going to do kind of half and half episodes. So we're going to talk a bit about team building for the first half. Then we are going to talk about pairing. So, and pairings particularly with team tournaments. So basically what pairings and kind of how do you go about getting better at pairings. So thank you again to everyone that have sent in your misplays. We're going to do another misplays section today. The amount of people that send in misplays over the plays is wonderful. It's glorious to see so many people happy to show how basically their cock-ups, which is fantastic. But let's get right into it. Let's start with team building. So Laurie, if we start with your fine self, and considering all your experience with team building, building Team England and sure various other teams that you've been on, I want to start with people because I like the kind of people factors about this, and it's kind of how to go around building a team of people. And we talked a bit about it in our first episode, the Worlds episode. But for you, in your experience, what's the kind of best route to building a team regarding people? Is it get people you're close to, that you're friends with, that you think are good players, or internationally speaking, is it about picking a group of people that get on, or are you just picking the best people for the job, as it were?
I mean, obviously the answer is you just pick your mates. I think that first and foremost is like
the easiest
and it always works. Mm-hmm.
However,
a lot of us are in this position, you have no mates, then what do you do in that position? I think a lot of this, we were just saying before the episode started, like a lot of this is based on ideal circumstances. And I think whatever team you're building, whether you're building one for an international event, as I was doing for Six Nations, or whether you're doing it for a team tournament, as I've done for Team Keen in the past and for the one I play a role in locally, you've got like only the people you can actually have available to you. When it comes to your team, you do not want too many big characters. I think if we're talking about personalities, then if you've got eight strong-willed big characters, all of whom have their own opinions and are sure that they're right, which annoyingly does often go hand in hand with people who often are quite good at Warhammer, at least, or at the very least think they're quite good at Warhammer. And so you if you have eight of those players, you can still win games. But if you're ever on the back foot or do lose a round or anything like that, then trying to get all eight of those people pointing in the right direction is hard work, and the chances of all of them being kind of happy over the weekend, I think, is quite hard. I found Six Nations enjoyable. I found it one of the greatest kind of management problems I've ever had, and I do manage on my day job as well, and trying to get everyone happy and kind of pulling in the same direction and happy with the list choices they have, as well as kind of our approach for the weekend, was difficult. And so I think in an ideal world, you probably want, like, if we're talking an ideal world, you probably want two or three big characters with big opinions, and then you probably want most of your team to be people who are willing to work for the team, really, and are willing to see the big picture and to appreciate that actually what the purpose is that the team basically doing as well as they possibly can. It really was Craig Namver, of all people, who the first team tournament I went to, we bumped into each other and he said, "How are you doing?" And I started listing off my singles results. And he said, no, "How's the team doing?" Like, oh yeah, that's what's important, isn't it? I was like,
yeah,
because that's what we're here for. And I think that's it. I'm sure Craig would deny all knowledge of that because he's, you know, competitive cutthroat, but but yeah, I think you want players who have actually that kind of attitude, and when don't kind of come away from it going, That was such a terrible game. How can you put me into that? You want someone who comes away from it kind of going, right, how did the team do? I managed to get 2 points. Has that made a difference for us? And are willing to offer their opinion, but also appreciate that other opinions do exist. As I say, that's quite a hard thing for any person to have. So I'm kind of dreaming up an imaginary person there to an extent, but that is what you want. You want some strong characters, certainly, people who are going to give opinions strongly, but you also definitely need lots of team players.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's very similar to kind of sports. Hmm. There's a lot of very, very good sports podcasts out there talking about team building, and they often mention your kind of, I don't want to call it star players, but you know, those players that they know they're good, they are really good, and they go out and do the job, but may not necessarily be the ones to kind of bigging up the rest of the team. And actually, you need different cogs for the machine to work, right?
Yeah.
And so you need that kind of that mixture. And just sticking with you quickly, Laurie, so does that fit in with the factions that you pick for a team? So that was going to be my next question anyway. So you're thinking about your ideal team of people. Does that go for factions as well? You're looking for a nice mix of factions, or are you sort of, you're just basically trying to pick the best ones to do the job?
I think it's six of one, half a dozen of the other. I think you do want the best factions, obviously. And so at the both Worlds and Six Nations, one of the factions which we locked in, which obviously Darren ran, was Seraphon. Like you're the top broken factions. You're just like, right, they are there. And that's going to be two or three of your lists are just going to be kind of decided for you, basically, that you're taking those factions because you know that they've repeatedly gone 5-0 and that whatever version of them you take is going to be super strong. At that point, I think then the rest of the list you're picking, you are having to take a much more nuanced approach with. So it might be like if you could, obviously you can't, but if you could purely rank factions based on their relative strength, and you could just list off the top eight. If you've got your top two, which are broken, busted, and you're going to take, and then the next six are all shooting armies. Maybe the next six are, you know, it's the year of shooting, and they're all shooting. Actually, taking six shooting armies is a terrible idea for teams, because you'll come up against every other team will have a deepkin list, and you'll just have basically auto losses against all those deepkin. So you're still taking strong lists. I definitely think there is such a thing in teams as trying to create too clever of a setup. Mm. And being like, right, we've got four super clever teams lists, and then they come into just good singles lists and they lose. But you are also having to weigh up, like, there's no point in having five lists which basically all play in the same way and all have exactly the same weaknesses as well. And I think that's that kind of marry up between the two of them. So you want lists that can do different roles, but married up with people who can do kind of that team attitude as well.
Yeah, absolutely. It makes perfect sense. Darren, how'd you agreeing along? I know you and Laurie have lots of crossover with Team England. Building a team for you, being in these teams, often not. I want to reference, was it not this year, the previous year when you guys won? Was it the year before or 2 years ago? God, I can't even remember now. And I know Nigel came along and wasn't playing, but the amount of wonderful compliments he got from how to help build the team from a morale point of view.
The cutest man in Warhammer. Yeah.
Yeah. And so
we love Nigel.
Kind of relevant to what Laurie was talking about. How you find being in a team and what you think kind of works. And also B, what do you think about having kind of personalities outside of the playing team as a benefit?
I fucking love teams. And people fascinate me. If you enjoy people watching, then just go to an Age of Sigmar team event and watch various teams do pairings, or watch how people interact at lunch, watch how people manage a loss or not, because we all do it so differently, so uniquely. It's fascinating. So yeah, being part of a team is great. It's my favourite way to play Warhammer. As for those little support pieces like Nigel, what was great about Nigel was if anyone had a difficult game, you know, you go up to someone, if you've had a hard game and you go up to one of your teammates and they've had a great game, they can't really get how you're feeling. And there might even be a little bit of resentment. Whereas you can go to Nige or someone that's not played a game at all, and they're purely focused on you. You know, they want to ask how your game went, what you could do better, or all sorts of stuff. They're not desperate to tell you about how their game went, which is, I think, is super useful. And that's the sort of thing that it's also the sort of thing a player coach can provide as well. Tom's very, very good at that. He's got such a good sort of poker face when inside he's dying because he's really bored about you telling him about his game. He's had 8 other people's games as well, you know. But yeah, it's super important to have that slight disconnect from the fact that you've just been in an intensive game.
And how have you found being in the teams? I know maybe it's me coming in from the outside, but I know non-international teams, I would say you've been in a few teams with some very big personalities. With regards to what Laurie was saying about, obviously, you don't want everyone big personalities. How have you found those teams for you? Something that you're happy to be in?
I've not intentionally thought, I've got the My Hills who are massive, you know, personalities. I best not go get another personality. I've not sort of really thought about team dynamics in that way. What normally happens is I've got a lot of friends in Warhammer and I'm desperate to go to team events with them. So I'll try and ask them. They my teams are sort of formed organically, you know, over a beer or over a game. And then, wouldn't it be great to... Like I played Dan Ford at Masters, you know, and I love talking Warhammer with Dan Ford. So I was like, we should form a team. And I wasn't thinking, who would Dan suit me or this, that, and the other. So those teams are. I tell you, when that instant does come up is when you've got a team and then someone can't come or someone for a reason drops out, you know. Then you're in a spot where you've got to think, right, there's quite a few people I could ask, and you go through who's going to suit the team the best. That's the only time that sort of situation's occurs.
If I could interject, Darren,
of course.
That's an interesting point there, because we do, like, internationals aside, you do pick teams based on who your mates are. Like, you do the teams you're sending off to Brotherhood or to Blood Tithe or whatever, you're picking your mates. Like, if you were picking it from a competitive point of view, do you think actually, if you went, right, I've got the Mihawks, I've got Chris and Rick, they're strong characters who are going to take, like, I like Chris and Rick, but they're going to take janky lists, aren't they? They're going to take
what they're going to take. They're gonna take.
That's their way. Like, if you were actually building a team and, like, approaching it kind of in a professional, competitive kind of manner, would you actually say that you probably should be going, right, I need people who are not like the Mihawks as my next few. If it's a six-man team, my next two or three, they need to be people who are going to take what the team agree is the best take and are going to be quite calm and level-headed about it. Maybe not calm and level-headed, but are going to kind of be much more going with the flow.
I think that very much depends on the individual. Like, I'm more than comfortable having a bit of chaos in my team because the local scene, the people that I've grown up with, how we play Warhammer is just utter chaos. And also there is value in your opponents not having a fucking clue what your lists do. You know, that can help you in pairings, that can help you in the games, that can help you in people preparing. Because sometimes people, if you put a wacky list into your team build, on the run-up to the event, people are then concentrating on trying to figure that out, and then they're not doing the basic stuff against the other more lists that they feel they have figured out.
That is kind of my point, is that, like, I'm not disputing that the Mihawks add something or characters like the Mihawks add something. And I mean, the most famous example, not famous, one of the best examples of that was Byron's Bonespit list 2 years ago in Worlds, which was just a ridiculous list. completely bonkers. Like, what was it? 1,800 points in the end, because we worked out that having four extra command points was better than anything else in it, because it was just there. Like, that was that. But you don't want eight bonkers lists. We all did it because that, at that point, it becomes, in my opinion, becomes too clever. The matchup process becomes too chaotic. And so that's kind of what I'm getting. I'm not saying that people like the Mihawks or Byron's list and the list that the Mihawks write aren't appropriate for teams, but I'm saying if you were kind of approaching it not in a, I want to have fun this weekend because I'm taking a team and I want it to be my mates, if you're viewing it as, right, we're gonna win, we're gonna beat everyone in front of us, do you think that you should be picking people who kind of balance out the people you've got in your team?
So again, I answered that initially with, it's what you're comfortable with. I'm comfortable with that chaos because another thing as well, I don't think that I or necessarily the people in the South are the best players in the country. And we're not very good at formulaic Warhammer. And if I invited too many people onto the team or try to find people that are very formulaic, you know, that would be at odds with me. So it wouldn't necessarily resonate very well. Whereas someone like yourself, I think if there was too much chaos on your team, that would get on your tits, and that wouldn't help. So
I suppose that is kind of the point I'm kind of getting at, is that I think there is an element where you've got to put, in my opinion, you should put personal preferences to one side with the England setup. So I've captained England the last Six Nations, but been part of the selection committee for, I think, the last two teams, although I think one of those teams maybe didn't go because of COVID. And when we were picking players, you do kind of have to put, to an extent, personal prejudices or personal views aside as much as you possibly can, and be like, right, well this person doesn't play like I play, and that has been the case with some of the players we've picked. We've been like, look, their record speaks for itself, they are clearly a good player. And I think if you are approaching teams in that kind of scale, and there's a big difference between picking a team because you all want to have a great time, and teams Warhammer is arguably the best Warhammer, because there's, you know, six four of you having a great time over the weekend. But if you are picking it from an international perspective, then I think you do need to be able to put your personal prejudice to one side, or personal, maybe prejudice is the wrong word, your personal preferences is probably better, your personal preferences to one side. And yeah, like, if I look at the eight players who we took to Six Nations, some of those are very different players from me, with different attitudes to the game of playing. but that I thought was our strength, and something which, yes, maybe I have got a couple more grey hairs in the run up to it from dealing with, because Russ is quite, unless Russ has got an absolute smash face. This Russ Fuel is an incredibly good player, but he came into that with kind of a bit of a negative attitude to his list, which is always a very different approach to my view on my list, where I always think that my list can be anything because I embrace my list and embrace my attitude. And Russ is much more like, oh, I can just see. Russ, I think, ended up going that weekend either 4-1 or maybe 3-2.
He was running the gash.
He was running the gash and Blood Knights, indeed.
He had a negative attitude then, would you say, Laurie?
I would say that, except for that would be using incorrect grammar, Owen, which obviously I can't.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
He did. Well, a negative attitude.
Well, Laurie, I've never been in a position where I've been choosing an international. I've only been going to events outside of international Age of Sigma. I've only been like a player. I was the vice captain, but I wasn't in charge of any of the selection. So I think I agree with you 100%. If I was in that position, and me, the scale of it is bigger than me and it's bigger than my friends, then yes, you've got to put that all aside. 100%. If it's a domestic tournament, and my goal, I think, going to a tournament, it is very, very geared to winning, don't get me wrong, but it's also geared to the Friday night and the Saturday night. Right. And that's going to be a bit different to someone like yourself, I'd assume, you know.
So I think
all of that points for you 100%, but maybe not for me outside of an international.
You know what happens when you assume, Darren, don't you?
I know Owen's trying to get in here, but I was just going to say, absolutely fascinating listening to this conversation. So, Owen,
I think the thing that I got from that, and it was good that I like that. I love it when people can disagree, and you know, we have a proper debate, or not disagree, but have maybe differing viewpoints. And I think that goes to sort of a lot of what this game is about, like the transition from a singles mentality. And you go to tournaments and, you know, you want to do well. And there is an element of, there's a big element of ego to what we do, right? We like to, you know, be good at this game for whatever amount of, you know, personal self-satisfaction that gives. And being able to kind of like temper that and, you know, slot into a team and maybe regulate regulate your personality a little bit, you read the room and understand what kind of role you've got. But I think overall, like, the team is a collective, so there's always going to be a team identity. So whilst I haven't ever really been involved in sort of picking teams, you know, I was actually thinking about the tournaments I've been to. I think I must have been to about 8 or 9 team tournaments now with a variety of different teams. And all of those teams, whilst certainly the Welsh teams have always had a core group, because, you know, starting back from Blood Tithe 2019, I think that's when the tournament you were talking about, when you won it with Dan, mm-hmm. and I think it was the two, was it Double Dan? And who else was in that team with you, Darren? Was it
Myhills, wasn't it?
No, I don't think it was. It was, what was the team that you won in 2019 with, Darren?
Will.
Yes, and Will, yes, of course. So that was the first tournament that I played in, and I hadn't met anyone in person with the Welsh team. And that team now has obviously developed, and Simon's now the captain, and it's grown. And I think when you're slotted into a team, like Laurie made reference to, there's always, you do have to, you want it to be a meritocracy. So you have to have people that know what they're doing. Mm. But at the same time, you have to make it so it's a sustainable environment. This is talking more internationally, like, you know, national teams. You don't want it to be a closed shop. And I think all the home nations have made efforts over the past, well, certainly since I've been playing Warhammer, to have this balance between
experience.
Yeah, success and longevity, you know, bringing in, you know, for example, like my mate Toby coming into the England team and obviously doing so well at Worlds and stuff. And, you know, you want to keep people hungry. So stepping back slightly, the identity of the team, you take your ego into it, but I think that to be successful, I certainly think the management element of the team have to be incredibly emotionally intelligent, and they have to understand, you know, who the kind of, let's put it in bunny ears, who the stars are, and putting people in, and then you have, and maybe those star players, they can play any faction. And then you want, one of the things that I thought about again with identity and with like roles, I think that there's, you definitely, certainly with new players coming into the team and things, you want to put them on an army that they know. You know, there's a lot to be said for reps, and you know, it's really, it is quite difficult. For example, if you're just sort of going, these 8 to 10 armies are the best armies in the game, X player, you're on Daughters of Cain, or X player, you're on Ideneth, just because we need somebody to play that, and so-and-so's earmarked this, so-and-so's earmarked that. So definitely having emotional intelligence in the way that the team's built and how to manage those personalities. I mean, I think talking about having 8 stars, it made me think of like the Galacticos era of Real Madrid, for anyone who's into football.
Yeah, I was literally, I mean, you're reading my show notes every time, Owen, so.
I don't get the notes, baby. But yeah, that sort of Galacticos, you're right. When the shit hits the fan and you have a bad round or something, then, you know, the kind of stars all look at each other and think, oh, well, you didn't turn up or whatever, or you didn't perform. But yeah, that emotional intelligence in the management section of the team is super important, and making people understand their roles and be like, 2 points this round is like a 20-0. Get us 2 points and you know, you're winning for the team. And I think it will go on to pairings. I don't know a huge amount of, obviously from a player's perspective, I can give some, but definitely that management element and in the team saying, you know, people understanding their roles and what they need to get each round. I think you do need that strong core at the top. And I think from a list point of view as well, I would agree with the point Laurie was making around, it's obvious, it's always very obvious what the super strong armies are. And in certainly in 8-man teams, maybe 5, I would say, are kind of locked in. And I think in an 8-man team, you maybe have room for that one kind of like gatekeeper-y kind of wacky list, you know, like Simon's Demon Princes for the Welsh team at Worlds. I think he would agree with me that it didn't work out exactly as he wanted, but like that, there is room for that kind of super techie list, which can, you know, cause a bit of havoc in the pairings process. I don't know if I've got one overall cogent thought on teams, but definitely it's a balance between having people in the team that know how to win games of Age of Sigmar, having people who then know how to manage people is really important, like on the table, off the table. Like having like a logistical setup in terms of making it so that all the players are there on time, and
there it is. I was waiting for the logistics word to enter. Yeah,
you know, like all that stuff. Like we didn't stay at the hotel of the venue for Worlds, so the logistics element around, you know, multiple mini cabs and everyone getting there on time and breakfast.
Well, this is what I wanted to mention, Owen, because Laurie did mention managing people and that it was stressful, and I can imagine it is stressful with especially adults, and everyone's got their own opinions. And I know you've mentioned in previous episodes that you felt a bit like the dad of the Welsh team before, and how important it is to have that kind of, I guess, dad figure on management or logistics, have that kind of logistics set up just to make it easy for the team to perform, right?
100%, yeah. I mean, I would say Simon, prior to being captain, was kind of, he was also a dad figure. I remember at Brotherhood, the first Brotherhood, it was he and I who were cooking all the breakfasts in the Airbnb. Here we go. We're not onto tips yet, but top tip for any team, try and get an Airbnb when you all stay together. I think you guys, I mean, Laurie, I know that you're a proponent of that. I think the English team all stayed together at previous Six Nations, I'm pretty sure.
Yeah, we couldn't get an Airbnb most recently, but we were all staying in a bunch of hotel rooms above a pub. So that all worked in the same kind of way. And then, I mean, that was beautiful. That really, really worked. And then, Airbnb before that.
I think that element of, like, you can't manufacture camaraderie, you know, you can't manufacture brotherhood, for want of a better word. Well done, Chris Tomlin. Excellent name for a team tournament. and, you know, brotherhood, sisterhood, allhood. I don't know if that's the correct term.
Maybe siblinghood.
Siblinghood. There we go. Well done.
Rolls of the tongue. Rolls of the tongue.
There has to be, it has to be about more than just, you know, rolling dice and, you know, winning and losing. You know, it's not a cheap hobby. I think our most precious commodity, certainly as we've come out of lockdown, et cetera, COVID, is our most precious commodity is time. So if you're going to spend your time with people and all be working towards this goal, then I think, you know, having that element of a common goal and camaraderie and making sure that the team has an identity and pushes in the same direction and enjoys being with each other, enjoys celebrating the successes and enjoys, well, not enjoys, finds ways to deal with disappointment and build. It's like, what's that cheesy saying I say sometimes? It's like when you lose, it's like a muscle tearing. And then when the muscle tears, then it gets bigger and you always learn more from your losses, et cetera,
You're getting swole from a team point of view.
Yeah, I mean, but think about it. It's like if you finished every game of singles and then you had 7 to 10 people that evening to, you know, either just unload on or talk about what you could have done differently. It's like an amazing opportunity to learn. I'll stop talking in a second, but basically Teams is great. And at the last Brotherhood, I was part of a brand new team in Team Lit, which is something that Adam Mumford and Matthew Davis, Matt Mallow are putting forward. And
great shirts.
Great shirts. That custard yellow. Legends in training, by the way. If you didn't know, that's what Lit means. It's not just a kind of...
Is that what it is?
That's what it is. And there was some...
Who's training them?
I mean, we're training each other. This is the point. We're all learning together.
I think Matt's training all of you, to be honest with you.
If we all learn how to play Warhammer from Matt Mallow, then it would be some real MPE shit. I love you, Matt, but he just wants to sit at the back of the board and win somehow. But yeah,
he's, shout out to Matt Mallow.
Special player, very special player.
Absolutely fascinating, this conversation. I feel like I'm sort of a listener because it's fascinating. And we mentioned quickly before we went on air about how, unlike sports that have been going on for decades, this is all very new and how, you know, this is just how we're trying, or more experienced talkers on this podcast, how trying to build a team and going and kind of learning as we go, which is all absolutely fascinating. But just before we get to the pairings bit, I did want to quickly ask, I'll start with you, Darren. We have mentioned lists and we have mentioned factions already. The one thing I do want to ask, and we had some questions about this, how do you go picking? So we said that obviously some of the top factions are obvious, and some of them are going to be kind of atypical off meta picks for the last few. How do you have a way of picking what sort of lists that you want to go into a team perspective? And what I mean by that is, do you go into the team thinking, right, we want 2 to 3 real aggro lists. We want 2 to 3 that can kind of get close draw type lists, and we've got 2 to 3 that can sort of sit at the back slash not give away too many points. Is it that granular? Do you go in thinking we want this spread, or is it again more fluid than that?
That's way too organized for the likes of the people I go to team events with, or certainly me. To be fair, if I'm the person in charge, then I don't go to that level of and that obviously filters down into the team. Before I answer that quickly, I do want to build on one of the points that Laurie mentioned and then Owen mentioned, because I was waiting for an appropriate time to do so.
Please do.
With regard to, you know, the picking the top eight, most team events limit how many people can have a certain artifact or how many people can use this, that, and the other, endless spells. So some factions... value really drops off when they're not able to use a certain endless spell, for example, or Arcane Tome is another example. So if you were really keen to have legions in your army and you had Kairos with portals, then taking Tzeentch is probably not going to be on the cards, because Tzeentch without portal loses a great deal of value. So that's another sort of consideration, how you... the people that get the cream, the first choice of all the bits and bobs, the people that can't operate without their portals, that filters down. And quite often, because you someone else that you want in your team is someone that's adaptive, because or people and people without ego, people like Ricky Mee.
Yeah.
That can you can go to them, right, you've got no choice because everyone else has taken, you've got the last choice, and we're going to change what faction you're on because we don't actually think what that Skaven are good with the rest of our team build.
If I could add on top of that, like Ricky Mee is a great example. There's a couple of people we talk about the Six Nations team, but I'll start with Ricky. Like he, so as Darren said, we were running 9 Storm Fiends with Ricky, then we tried with 6 Storm Fiends with Ricky, and we ultimately came to the decision that it just wasn't quite competitive enough. It relied too much on spells and the small characters. So in the build up to Six Nations, like, right, Ricky, we want to put you on Archaon. We had my Archaon list that I'd gone really well with. I'd gone one face hammer with it, and I'd gone 5-0 a team tournament with it as well. I managed to say I didn't go 5-0 at face hammer because that's the one which Darren always takes a piss at me from always saying, but I fucking did. So I said to Ricky, well, will you run this for us? And Ricky said he would. And so last minute, and Ricky's someone who does like to get games in with it, and obviously he can down endorse it, so he got lots of games in. And then even on top of that, like, we came around to the final stages of it. And the list which I'd been running had got Arcane Tome on the Sorcerer Lord, and had got Master of Magic as the Grand Strat. Not Master of Magic. Keep a Wizard Alive, whatever that Grand Strat used to be called.
Prize Sorcery.
Cheers, Owen. Prize Sorcery. And then we realized that actually Prize Sorcery has to go on... God, who do you put it on? Maybe Nagash we put it on. Basically, someone else was just a better fit for Prize Sorcery. It's JP and Lumineth, of course it was. Prize Sorcery obviously fits better on Lumineth than it does on Archaon. And so instead, Ricky had to, well, suddenly we realized this was towards the end and was a mistake on my part, really, had to take Keep a Priest Alive. No idea what that Grand Strat was called. I don't know if anyone else can remember.
Pillars of Belief.
Pillars of Belief. That's right.
There you go. Just love that. because he had one war shrine in his army, Ricky did. And so basically he had to spend all his time protecting that war shrine on top of everything else in the army, in the game. And then Ricky went away and went 5-0 with the list. And that's someone who I'm not saying that he grinned at every single little curveball I threw his way, but certainly someone who, for the good of the team, was willing to accept that actually this is what's needed. Like if Skaven is a decision that it's not competitive enough, I'll take what you take. All right, that's not viable. I'm the one who has to compromise on Grand Strat and artifact. Fine. And there was justification behind it, obviously, but that was still remarkably like level-headed from someone. And I certainly don't think I would have been as level-headed as Ricky was.
It was commendable.
And to take it and then still have belief in the list and still just play your game. And he took some reds and made them wins, and took some greens and made them wins. So he smashed face. And to just chat about someone else on top of that, of a similar vein, Terry at the same tournament. I think Terry twice with his Nurgle list played against Lumina Thoxes. One time where there were, I'm not sure if you remember the table, Owen, because I mentioned it to you.
I remember vividly, don't worry. Yeah. In the back corner, Laurie. Yeah.
That one there had two big pieces of impassable terrains on it, which is tough for Nurgle at the best of times. And then you're playing against foxes. And Terry, just at the end of it, in Terry's kind of way with a slight grin and a slight speckle of emotion, was just explaining how shit a game he had. And that was kind of it. Like, Terry had we had a pint that evening, and Terry did moan about bemoan having to play that list on that table. But next day wasn't bitter about it. It wasn't kind of, oh, am I going to get bust again? It was, right, who am I playing today? And then I think he played Rick Myhill the next day and played a superb game of Warhammer. With real clever play by Terry, I thought. And I just thought, yeah, that's a player who like, because Terry is. If you don't mind me saying, Darren, Terry, in terms of his emotions, is very different from you, isn't he?
Oh, like, God, yeah.
You win, and you win big, and that's great for the team, and that buoys the team along. And that is someone who, like, if you know you've got someone who's a big character in your team, I think Jack Armstrong plays a similar role. You've got big character who you know is likely to go 4-1 or 5-0, and when they win, the whole team gets confidence from that. But you don't want 8 of those, because you're not going to have 8 players going 5-0. You want players who also are just going to take the team role and want to just yeah, are just going to kind of take the wins and the losses and treat them both the same, as the old poem goes.
Mm-hmm. One thing I would say, Laurie, and I don't want to blow smoke up your ass, but I think the management element of the team would need to take credit for the way in which the players accepted the decisions that were given to them. For example, let's take Ricky, for example, in terms of, you know, I was on a similar experience with Worlds in terms of, you know, a late list change and, you know, wanting to be in a position to, you know, play more games, etc. But, you know, my mum used to always say to me, it's not what you say, it's how you say it. And, you know, being able to manage that personality to, you know, there's a balance between, you know, the way in which the player accepts it, but also the messaging from up high has to be correct in terms of the way that you lay out the case. So I think some, you know, you should take some credit for that as well, I would say.
I think I generally got it right. Sometimes not, but
definitely
not going to go out the podcast. So yeah.
And just before we go back to Darren, because I know he's got some follow-up points as well. Just related to that, Laurie, again, the same sort of question I asked to Darren, knowing that and knowing those personalities, would you therefore, before you go into a tournament, for example, give Terry the defensive blocker list and therefore give Jack and Darren the aggro lists, or is that not really a consideration currently for kind of team?
I think it very much is, actually. I think, in my opinion, it really is. I think you do. I think there's an element that players quite often will pick and be comfortable with lists that match their personalities to an extent. But you do. I think you want, like, Darren is a good player. And you want him on a list which is kind of suiting that. Basically, Darren does like to smash face, and so you want him matched up with that kind of list. Terry is a grindy player, so you want him on a grindy list. Another good example, which I was thinking about as Owen was chatting, is Steve Kerr. Steve Kerr is an excellent player, but by his own admission, he needs reps. Like, he really needs reps with a list to be. Wants to take it to tournaments, wants to get loads of games under his belt. So in comparison, Bradshaw, who Dan is happy like a couple of weeks out to kind of go, actually, I think this is stronger, let's swap to that. And I think in the build up to our list submission for Six Nations, Dan might have been on two or three different types of armies, and then took another different army to Worlds as well. And like, Dan's really comfortable with that. But if we'd done that with Steve, that would have lost what little hair he's got left.
Shout out to Steve.
And yeah, and with Giants, I think Steve went 4-1 that weekend at Six Nations, and that's because obviously he had the time to prep them and knew the army inside and out, and as a result of that, I felt confident with it. And so there would have been no point. I think if I'd said to Steve the week before the event, right, take this busted army, he still wouldn't have felt comfortable with them, and yeah, that really wouldn't have suited him. So you can always give someone an army which is very strong, and if they're a good player, they'll still do well with it. You do also think about the kind of players you've got underneath you, so to speak, and what they feel comfortable with. For example, again, just talking about JP, who JP was another excellent team player the whole weekend. JP wanted to take Lumineth, and he would have taken something else. But you've got to think about how much more you're getting out of JP by putting him on the army that he feels most comfortable with. If I'd said to JP, right, I want you to take Cruel Boys, which at one point I was thinking of doing, then he would have done it, and he would have done it and got games in with it, and I'm sure he'd done very well. But I wouldn't. That would not be utilizing JP to the best of his ability, which I think is part of what you're trying to do.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely.
One tiny thing to add to that, sorry, is that from an analysis point of view, when you're looking at other teams, definitely when you see a player who's not on an army they know, because like we all know what each other play, and you know there's stats and there's, you know, there's evidence to show what people are playing. As soon as you see somebody who's on something, you're like, ah, well, they weren't bringing that for the last few tournaments, or they've never really played that army. That can put a little flag up to maybe be, you know, perhaps a weak point in the team dynamic. So, you know, it kind of works externally as well as internally as well.
I know it's going back and forth between me and others, but there is occasionally exceptions to that. I think, like, with particularly strong armies. The first Six Nations I went to as a player, I took Daughters of Cain, and I took just the standard build, which was Mrathi, you know, a couple of Hag Queens, Cauldron, and then loads of Witch Elves. And I went 5-0 that weekend, and I'd played three games of it prior to the weekend. Mm. And that's not me blowing, I mean, it is a little bit me blowing smoke up my own ass.
You're flexing all over,
I'm not getting a lot of exercise at the moment. That's the only way to do that. But it really isn't, because it was a very, very strong list. And it was also a very good list to match with, because basically if the opponent had nowhere to put them, you had 30 Witch Elves and a 5-up rerollable armor save, which were mine raised up and would just roll stuff. So there are some lists, like occasionally you'll have a list that is so strong that you can give it to a player who is a good player and is an experienced player, and they will just go with it. But I completely agree with your general sentiment, Owen. I just wanted to kind of throw in there are occasionally exceptions.
Perfect sense, and that will nicely lead us into our pairing section. Before we get there though, Darren, you had a few points left to make.
I've got one important one please. That I'd like to make, and this is for people that aren't in control of selection, but the potential at the beginning there's a little bit where we all decide what armies were going on. And some people, like me, have to play Seraphon because the team bullies you into it. There are other people that say, there are other people that could genuinely pick any list. If you are one of those people and your team captain or your vice captain or anyone else says, you know, what do you want to take? What role do you want to have? And you answer with this, oh, I'm very flexible. I can do anything. Fuck off. You don't understand yourself. Like, it's people think that that's what we want to hear. And I'm saying this when I've been in that, you know, been in that selecting position. That isn't helpful. That's not what I want to hear. What I want to hear is, okay, I'm impatient. I want to be on an army that's getting into them. I'm not very good at castling. I don't like this mission. I don't want to be using like Nurgle. I don't want to use this, that, and the other. It's because that's information that's useful in so many different ways. You absolutely 100% are not comfortable doing anything. You know, get that shit out of your head. Understand yourself and then be honest. You know, I'm a fucking child. I am impatient. I need to be on something that acts straight away. I need to be on something that can make creative plays so I can go about later and tell people about it, because that's what
you really do know yourself, don't you, Darren?
No, I do, because I put a lot of effort into that, and I think I'm a much better player for it. And that is so many, it just stresses me out when people say, oh, you know, I can use anything. I'm easy. I don't have any preference. Fuck off. Of course you do. Of course you do. Just be honest.
It's like that all green matrices, isn't it? Yes, I said it.
All the green matrices. I knew it was going to come in with this episode. Yeah.
Yeah.
We don't want people that, you know, making out that you can play anything. That doesn't make you, I don't think that makes you a better player. You understand yourself a bit more. Put a bit of thought into who you are, what role you want to take on the team, and be honest. You know, if someone puts you on a list and you need portals, but someone else wants it, stick up for yourself. Say, well, I this list works or this faction works, but I need portals. Hmm. And if I don't have it, then I need to be on something else. You know, that's the sort of thing you need to have a bit of grit about you.
And that kind of mixes with what we were talking about with the different mixing of different players, different styles, and all kind of melding it into what would hopefully be not the perfect team. That's impossible, but you know, an optimized team, as it were. Owen, did you want to?
All I was going to say is that I 100% agree with Darren's statement, but I think as well from the senior player or like the management team, as I've sort of framed it, there needs to be somebody or multiple people in that management team that then support that voice, because if that voice is a new voice, it can be quite daunting going into a team with a lot of experienced players and names. And if you're like, I'm playing Nagash, I need fucking portal, and somebody else is saying, well, I want to play with Kairos and I need portal, then, you know, you need people to then prop up those quieter voices. It's a bit like in a classroom, you know, when there's always the one person that's putting their hand up, and the teacher will then support one of the quieter students to then give their answer, and they might have something fantastic to say. It's just that they're not as confident as the other pupils. If you follow my analogy,
very wise.
It's really important that people feel heard. You know, even if you don't get the result that you're after, still say something. And it's important that if you are the person listening, that you hear it, and then you give an actual reason other than, well, I like the other person or I'm scared of the other person. Mm.
Yeah. I mean, this I could talk about this for absolutely hours, but I think let's jump into the second bit about pairings, but absolutely fascinating conversation by all of you. Pairings, very briefly, Laurie, if I start with you, just tell the listeners roughly kind of what we even mean by pairings, and kind of what goes through your mind when you're doing pairing. So we've sort of mentioned lots of things I was going to ask already. So you mentioned about your kind of doc list and how it's quite a good list to put out there. But just very, very briefly, I know it's a very layered question, but very briefly, what exactly are pairings, and kind of how do you go about doing that process?
So pairings is the process by which you work out who's playing who in a team tournament. And it's where you and the other captain and your vices, if you have them, will take it in turns to put down different armies and then match into each other effectively. And what you're trying to do is you're trying to get the best possible matchups that you can by through this process. To aid with this, teams or competitive teams who are tryhards will create these matrices. There's the word. Beforehand, and so you'll colour your different matchups. So if you've got the time, you'll go through the other teams and you'll grade all of the matchups as green for good, orange for okay or average, and then red for bad. Well, that's the standard way of doing it. I know other teams have done more detail ways of doing it. There's a whole discussion to be had there about what does green mean? What are you saying with green? And there's a whole discussion to be had there again about like...
Oh, Laurie, are you reading my show notes as well? You and Owen, eh?
You shouldn't have sent it to us in advance, Alex. That's on you. That's part of like the problems, the dilemma, and what someone might cut as a green might be different from what other people see as a green. And do you want your team to be overly negative or overly positive? For me, when I really enjoy matchups. I really enjoy the matchup process. As I said before, I found parts of being captain enjoyable, parts of it being quite stressful, and sometimes both at once. But the matchup process, I just really find fun, and I think I really, really relish that. For me, what I'm always trying to do is get greens for players who haven't got many greens. So
yep.
When you're looking at your matrix, if it's a singular, it's a matrix, right? And you're looking at it and you're seeing your player who's got two greens and then six reds. If you can get him into a green, you are effectively up against the opponent, because that's something which realistically they should be getting a win against that list, because they've got six out of their eight lists are good into that list. And so you want to be, if you can, getting a green for that. If that's not possible, then you want this person who unfortunately, for whatever reason, hasn't got a good range of matchups this round. You want them to take out a red that is mostly red for the rest of you. So often at Six Nations, that was Seraphon, because obviously Seraphon are a terrible army. And
preach. Preach, Laurie. Fucking preach, brother.
Is the actual name, Laurie.
Sorry, Alex. You're the narrative expert here.
Yeah, absolutely.
And so for example, with Seraphon, like if I think back to the Seraphons we were playing against, we probably had one or two ambers into them. I remember Dan Bradshaw was an amber because his IDK had got game against them, but quite narrow game. And then there was lots of reds. So we would, if someone was going to take, if for example, we had JP who had they've coming up against a whole lot of shooting lists in the opponent's set of lists, and 6 out of 8 of them were reds for him. And we put him down early on, and we get given a choice of Seraphon or what's a bad shooting list? Skaven. There was a Skaven list and Seraphon list. And JP, we put JP down, and we've been given those two options, JP with Lumineth. Now, I know that JP's got a lot of red out there. So of those two options, I'm just going to accept he's got a bad loss and just take Seraphon out and go to JP. And this links back to the type of players you want. JP, sorry, you're getting bust this round. Soz about that. In fact, I actually did it with Russ, final game against Northern Ireland. Put him into Stephen Mitchell's Thunder Lizards and said to him, sorry, Russ, but I think we ended up with 7 greens that round and 1 red, and Russ was the red. And I was like, look, by doing this, we just got green for the rest of the round. And yours is a big, fat, ugly red, as it was, he won anyway. But that's because we'd wound Russ up by that point. He'd gotten a roll and he was unstoppable. But that was a really good example of me kind of going to Russ, look, I've really bust you here. Like, you're properly, this is something which you really didn't want to play against. You've not got strong natural game into, but it's really just opened up the rest of the round for us. And so that's what I'm trying to do. I'm trying to get people into greens when they've got narrow options available to them. But I'm also trying to take out those big reds as if I can early doors, and then trusting myself to be able to outmaneuver the other person in the pairings process. Yeah. One final point, and then I will stop talking about this as I really, really like it. One other thing I think I'm doing, which was interesting chatting to Darren over the weekend, Six Nations, because I think he does something differently, is I try to get greens quite early on. Like, my approach is, if I can lock in 4 greens, or if I can get 4 greens out of the first 5 matchups, then I'm kind of like, right, I can probably get another couple of greens just in the tit for tat, because the final few stages get quite chaotic. Like, the beginning bit of it, it's quite like, right, I go, you go, you've got one off me there, but I've got one of you in return quite often. And so my approach is, if I can get lots of greens locked in early on, then at the end, where it gets really chaotic and kind of, you quite often go, right, I put this here and then that there, and then, oh, right, that means that this person is playing that person. I've got no real control over that at that point. Then I always think that I'll probably get another couple of greens at that point, and then we'll have the balance of the round.
Yeah, that makes perfect sense. And I'm going to come to Darren in a second, because I know you guys do differ slightly about pairings, which is, again, fascinating. And this, I don't mean this to be facetious a question, but do you look at how green is green to you, Laurie, is going to be my question. And what I mean by that is, are you taking into account, you know, as we met, let's just say Seraphon, or sorry, Space Lizards, are kind of super green. Does that kind of go into it at the same time, or are you just kind of taking it at face value and saying, look, the players have made the matrices and I've got the greens and the reds? Or are you kind of thinking even more in depth through the green?
So I think, sorry, I'll try to keep this as succinct as I can. I think there's a couple of levels to that question. I think something which I would do in future, if I had a role in any England team, would be to really establish beforehand what I mean by green. How, as you say, how green is green? I would be like, right, this green means that you'd be expecting to win this 4 times out of 5 if you met it at a tournament, or 9 times out of 10. Or I'd be saying you're expecting to get I'd be worried about putting a score on it, because I think dice are dice. But I think saying to people, look, if you're expecting to win this 9 times out of 10, like, establishing what green is, what amber is, and establishing what red is. And like, I think red even more so, it'd be you going, I am not going to beat this. Like, this is a list which, it just is a massively hard counter to me, like Terry into Lumineth. Like, that's him going, I'm just not winning this. Or is red, you know what, I'd rather not play it. And that I think I would like to establish. Having said that, I do think there's the risk of becoming too granular, too modular with it, and breaking it down even further. And I do like the simplicity that red amber green gives you.
Yeah.
And it is really tempting to kind of go, right, we'll have like five levels and then we'll have another pairings element to it. And this will really give us all the data that we need to properly smash this pairings process. But I do think you also have to remember that you are doing this in relatively stressed conditions with a time restraint hanging over you. And it is an imperfect process. And so there has to be a certain element of gut going alongside the process. And
yeah, at that point,
information overload, as with every element of Warhammer, information overload is very much a thing that you want to avoid.
Yeah. Well, and that gut, as you get more experience, that gut
probably
becomes more data driven anyway, right? As you get more experience with that gut is either right or wrong, and then you've had that experience. Darren, Laurie mentioned that he tries to get greens early, and let's get to your viewpoint on the kind of pairings process. And also, I'd love you to mention about the scenarios, because we mentioned that off air, and I think that's just quite an interesting part of pairings.
I can answer this from two perspectives, one being the person that's ultimately in charge of the pairings, and then I was I had the honour of being Laurie's vice captain at Six Nations. So firstly, historically, my approach is very different now to what it was historically. I used historically twice, then I apologize. I think you know what I mean.
Historically. There you go.
Does that mean it's really, really old?
Really, really old.
Well, I am an old fucker. I was of the school of thought that would put down, I would, like, if my first choice would, it would tend to be the guy that's got the weakest matchups, so that I could, be better, Darren. The person that had the best matchups, right? The worst matchups, right? So that I could control, I could try and then take out one of their best players or one of their big lists, or and then try and get some big things at big greens at the end. I always thought that if you keep your strength in your hand, you know, and being, but then when I became Laurie's vice captain, hopefully, Laurie, you sort of noticed this, but I kept that opinion and that way of doing things very much to myself. I didn't, Laurie's very, very good at what he's done. I faced him pairings before. He's a very successful team player and he's also your captain. So you don't want to be arguing with your captain. You don't want it to be who's got the biggest dick competition. You want to get your dick out and accentuate your captain's dick. And that's what I've tried to do.
Wow. I'm sorry. I can't let that go. Fucking hell, Darren.
Such a way of words, Darren. Such a way of
words. Thank you. Thank you. Is that anyone? Is it a historical dick?
Well, what I mean by that is I decided very early on that I was going to go all in with Laurie's approach. I wasn't going to try and my ego was not going to be part of the pairings. I was going to fully support everything that Laurie's style. Now, as the tournament went on, I saw the power in this. You know, we'd had this discussion very, very briefly. That's interesting. So that's what we're going to do. Okay. I would have done, I normally do this, but I'm on board with how you're doing it. And it meant that when we were doing pairings, me and Laurie were laughing, joking, we relaxed, and we could spend a bit of time looking at our opponents who most of the time were arguing. They were calling over other players and having little discussions. Can you do this? Can you do that? That's fucking really bad. So I was really proud of how I supported Laurie. Hopefully you feel that way, Laurie.
I agree.
And then by the end of the event, I'm firmly on Team Laurie with Halleck, because the proof is in the pudding. We won. I'll flex for you here, Laurie. You won Six Nations, or we won Six Nations, but mostly, you know, I think a lot
We won.
You
team
want me
game.
To say?
Team game. Team game.
But the best that you could possibly do it. So no one's going to surpass us, right? That's pretty fucking cool. And that what I like is I'm very much a psychological player. And what I really like about this style of trying to get the greens early is it just piles the pressure on your opponents in the later stages of pairings. And you're sitting there happy as Larry. You've already got your four greens. there's four matches left and we're already four up. Hooray, fuck you. It was good from multiple perspectives. It certainly, I think it's better than my approach. Mm. And then I went to Worlds and I got to see the power of considering the scenario, which is again something I had never. I'm not so sure that was. It might have been for you, Laura, but I might not have picked up on how important the scenarios are when I was at Six Nation, but I certainly did at Worlds.
We did have it on the grid, so they were. We did have it. It was part of the process of it, but you're right. It didn't come up a huge amount, but there were a couple of ones where it was like that person can't play that match that scenario basically.
I've got a little head, and because of that means I've got a little brain. I can only take in so much information at any one time, you know. So I was still in awe of this better approach. I didn't see the power of the scenarios, but I did at Worlds. Jack, Luke, Tom nailed pairings. They really did well. And they really put a lot of work into considering the scenarios. And we've mentioned this before, but it meant that we got an average of 14 points in our red matches because we were really focusing, or they were really focusing on getting us in matches that we were good at, you know, in the scenario, which is, and that's brilliant. I mean, it's so simple. It's beautiful. I really like that. And I used a combination of these approaches when we when we went to Brotherhood this year, when I went to Brotherhood. With my team.
Quick question for you, Darren. Sorry, just to
interject. Yeah, go on.
How many different scenarios did you play at Worlds?
Oh, don't fucking ask me that. I've got no idea.
did you? Okay. Did you play?
I didn't sleep for 5 days, and all I ate was potato. So I've got no idea. It's all a fucking blur.
I would hazard a guess that if you were using pairings into scenarios as an element of the strategy, then I would imagine that you played the same mission more than once.
Yeah. So I was very good in the Vice, for example. So I probably played that a couple of times. And then I'm also very good, or my list was very good, I thought, into the one where you automatically win if you've got three.
Marking territory, yeah.
Yeah, oh, you're so good, Owen. When I grow up, I want to be just like you.
You need to get you commentating on stream or something, Owen, with that sort of knowledge.
Yeah, maybe. That might be an idea.
I was going to say, at Brotherhood, for me, that's a bit of a different kind of event. Like, I went to, what's that wonderful club in Cardiff? Very small, sticky floors.
Metros.
Yeah, so I went to their two evenings on the trot, and every time I did pairings, I was fucking hammered or hungover.
I've got a joke for you then, Darren. Do you remember what happened in the pairings on the Sunday morning when you played against Lit?
No, I don't remember anything, but go on, tell me.
Well, you all came in like the cat just dragged the whole team in, and you... I can't remember specifically what happened, but basically your pairings cards, which is a whole thing as well, they had pictures. They didn't have words on them. So you got halfway through your first pairing, and then we reminded you that that was Kragnos. That wasn't like some other list. And you were like, shit, we don't want that pairing at all. So note to everybody. Sorry to interject, Darren, but yeah, make your pairings cards. I think it happened at Rob's Super Series as well, in that they paired into what they thought was Archeon, but the card had a picture and it was just another Slaves to Darkness list. It was AD Max, Demon
Attention to Detail.
Get clear pairings cards to aid this process. But
we had that with one of our teams as well at the Cardiff team tournament. I was paired into the wrong scenario because the cards were wrong around. So I was paired into a awful Space Lizards list that I wasn't supposed to be. So
if I could just add my own little story on that. I remember at the first Six Nation that I played at, Alex Bruce, I was playing my daughter's a Kane list, and Alex Bruce was a green into me, or he thought he was a green into me, but he got paired into me on the old hero mission where there were two objectives and I had Marathi, and it was in the Realm of Life where Marathi started with 13 wounds. So even if he fought her every single turn, he could only kill her turn four. I remember him turning up on the table and shouting at his captain, who was what was his name? The old Wales captain before Mark.
That was Tom Loyne.
Yeah, Tom Loyne, thanks. Shouting at Tom, not on this scenario, green on anything else. But, yeah, that was,
I was playing next to you. Huh? Do you remember?
I rolled your dice for you, didn't I?
Yeah, you rolled a fucking one. Thanks very much. On L'Oreal's teleport.
Yep, play for God.
Yeah.
Going back to the sort of brotherhood there. Otherwise, I'll lose my train of thought.
Sorry, no, you're good.
You're right. It's not your fault. It's my scatty head. So we also didn't manage anything in the way of preparation. So we didn't have a matrices. We hadn't filled a matrices out or a matrix out.
Ooh, God, there's a joke here about filling a matrices out, but I did just say that, didn't I? Sorry, Alex.
Socks on, Owen. Keep your socks on, please.
You're probably going to have to edit that out, aren't you? Shit.
So we had very little in the way of prep. The night before, I did organise everyone to come down and have a meal together, and we were going to, you know, go through matchups and what we thought we were good at, this, that, and the other. But it got derailed when Rick and Ryan came down pissed out of their heads. So we went into it very, very. I went into pairings, you know, not in the best state and with very, very little information. So I thought, right, what I'm going to do is I'm going to fall back on. I'm just going to ask people, are you good in this scenario? Because there's a choice of two per round, right? Are you good in this scenario? Yes or no? You know, very simple information. And I purely based all my decisions on the scenario to get rid of the mental load and to mean that I had some sort of strategy. And that worked so well. I can't mention it. I'm mentioning this to back up that statement that it worked well. We took out the event.
Flex.
But there were other people there that had a 5 traffic light system, you know, and they had all these matrices and they had paper out and they were getting their mates to come in and their mates were then arguing with them. And I just sometimes keeping it simple really can help you because you can sit back and you can look at your opponent and you can be that guy that's all relaxed and having a joke about how little effort you've put into this and how much they're tryhards. You know, all of that is part and parcel of getting in your opponent's head, which I love to do. So you can overcomplicate things. So I think there's a real, and that's taught me that there is, not only have I seen it in practice, but then I've used concentrating on scenario. And if you've got no other plan, you know, or you're worried in any way, that's a really good way of just, you know, wiping the slate clean, especially if you get super stressed, because it's easy to get stressed, isn't it, when you're pairings, you know, you can revert back to that very simple tactic and it's got some real strength to it.
Yeah, absolutely.
About that.
And just before we end the section and go on to kind of mistakes and top tips, the last sort of question I wanted to ask, sort of related to the how green is green, going forward, so for future events, international events, etc., do you think it should be left to individuals to grade their green-red matchups after the factions are picked, or do you think it should be an overall or a kind of manager-style position to kind of choose that? And I'll go to each of you and I'll start with you, Owen. What do you think?
This is great because I was waiting to chip in and I've got quite a few thoughts on this because if I may, this actually goes to a greater point, which is we've talked a lot about what people, I don't do the pairings. Simon Weekly does the pairings for Wales and you guys have paired against him and he's a fantastic tactician in that element of the pairings. But as with anything in life, like, data's only good if it's correct data. So I would say, you know, taking ourselves away from being at the pairings desk and, you know, doing that from the player perspective, like, there's absolutely no point giving giving the matrices, putting that information, going, like, there's no point giving them shit data because that's going to create incorrect pairings. So, I would say that you should put teams, if you're going to go down that route. I actually like what Darren said around having a simple approach, and I 100% agree with him on pairing into scenario. I think that's huge. Because how many games are you like in singles? You're like, oh, you know, his army should beat mine, but I'm, you know, I can get up on the primary, or I'm good on this mission. You know what I mean? Like, that's really important. Anyway, good data. So, like, I actually quite like a 5 gradation, like 2 greens, 2 reds, and an amber. And, you know, you can attribute points to those, as in the amount of points you think you're going to get in the game. But I also take your point as well, Laurie, about how you can go too far and it can be a bit too messy. But in terms of the way that that data is gathered, I actually think it needs to go through like 3 stages almost. I think in teams I've been in the Welsh team, for example, we had almost like a buddy scheme where you would talk through your pairings with another player. That kind of happened organically, and then it sort of got picked up as well. And then also, I think that there comes a point where you almost have like this, I don't know if it's, I've written down the term communal data. So it's like there are layers of sort of analyzing that data and kind of questioning it and saying, are you sure? And, you know, so I think that it can't just be the night before someone goes, oh yeah, I smash Seraphon. Obviously that's really bad data straight off the bat. Cause nobody does. Sorry. I know we've been digging them out, but stupid. but yeah, definitely. The quality of the data, that's the key point I want to make. That I would say that, you know, have those conversations, buddy up with people. The matrix isn't something that just gets done and then submitted. It's like any document of importance, you know, it grows and it evolves. So, you know, having it on a G drive and being able to everyone comment and add and edit and stuff like that, I think is really good. And I know that we're trying to wrap up. And I agree wholeheartedly with exactly what Laurie and Darren have said. When the pairing starts, there should be no other fucker there. You know, everyone's seen the picture of Bill Souza versus the French team. You know, that is a guy who is prepared to do the pairings, and the team should be adjacent and ready to take that pairing and discuss or whatever. But all the work should be done ahead so that the guys have a super clear brain to then put the plan into place. So, yeah, that's what I've got to say.
Fantastic.
Pairing United is really important. Really important.
Thanks, Owen. Laurie, kind of touching again, sort of agree with what Owen was saying about kind of a team assessing the green, or do you think managers going forward in the future might be an option?
I largely like what Owen was saying and agree with it. I think this idea, the idea of a buddy system, I think that's a really good solution to the problem of people being overly positive or overly negative. I think I mentioned earlier, having a team approach there is quite helpful. Like if you as team captain are clear, right, I'd like you all to be overly negative, then that can be quite helpful. Like if that's what you're saying as a base level, there's an element of knowing your team there as well. I know that Tom Morsley has talked a lot about how the favorite person what used to be his favorite person to manage was always Tony Moore, because Tony was just so good at knowing what he'd get from a game. He'd kind of go, right, I'm going to get you 15-5 here, and would. And so if you know that you're getting reliable data from a player, then that helps. And you might know that Jeff is a little bit optimistic and that Phil is a little bit pessimistic. And so having those elements to it is good too. I think an important point though, which Owen didn't mention, is that whilst a buddy system checking it, a second level of going over them is good. If a player doesn't believe the data which you've assigned to them, then that really undermines the whole process. Interestingly, with the aforementioned list of Russes, he hadn't got loads of games in before Six Nations of that. And so as a result, him and James Tinsdale did the matchups together. And I think there was that element that Russ didn't quite feel as much ownership of the matchups as if he'd done them all by himself, having played 4 or 5 tournaments with the army. It was a result of the position we found ourselves in. And in the end, as I say, it worked well. But I certainly think that there is that element, that risk there. If someone creates their own matchups, and then you go through them and you go, well, look, I think actually this is a green for you. You put it down as a red. I think that's a green for you. If the player then goes into that matchup, which you've got as a green, but in their head, they're still thinking, oh, that's a red. Then that's, again, that's dodgy data potentially, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah. Makes perfect sense. Darren, same to you. What do you think? Agree with the other two?
Case by case basis. Depends on who you've got on your team. It depends how, like Laurie pointed out, some people are very pessimistic. Other people have got no fucking idea how terrible they are. So you have to, it's a case by case basis. For me, it's a mixture of the two. But I will keep what I ultimately feel very, what I say and what I actually feel are often two very different things. If you are the person that's in charge of the pairings, because you don't just have that raw data and that raw information in front of you, you've got to think about the emotional state of your players as well. So I very rarely like to use the term bus, for example.
Yeah.
You've been bust. Yeah, fuck that. It's a self-fulfilling prophecy. I think you can acknowledge that someone's in a difficult spot, let's say, but you don't need to concentrate on it. Concentrate on more what they can do in a game rather than, you know, whether or not they're fucked. So I never use that term. So those sort of, when you are in control, I'll take what someone thinks. And if I think something different, sometimes I will change it, but it will also depend on what stage you're at in the pairings. If they're going very well, then you can push it and you can hope for a bit more from a game from someone. So that kind of evolves as the pairings are going on, that those sort of decisions, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it does make perfect sense.
I think there is that point worth noting is that you are ultimately the person doing the matchups. So if there is a green that you know is a green and this person might be sure it's a red, but you know it's a green, you can still match it, do the matchup as if it's a green in your head. You might not change on the process and you might be like, oh, sorry, you know, giving you a bit of a tough one, but I believe in you. I think you've got the potential here to do it. Because in your head, you're like, right, I've done this matchup 100 times myself. They've just had bad luck in the past. They will smash this. And like, you have got that. You are ultimately the person in charge. So you might not have to change it actually on your matrix or your matrices. You might just change it informally in your head.
Yeah.
What I found quite often in being on any team is when people look to the experience and, you know, as funny as it may sound, people do look to me for sort of advice before sort of games. Quite often you can say, well, you can do this, that, and the other. You know, you can play in this way. And it might be some way that they've not sort of realised. And then they go, oh, and it clicks for them. Oh, you are right. You know, so you can turn, because it might be in a scenario, in a matchup that they hadn't seen it the way you had. Because all the information at the beginning isn't going to be 100% correct. There's no way you can get that. So don't be afraid. What I'm trying to say is don't be afraid to change. Oh God, this sounds terrible, really. But change the data on the day. You know, it could be you've got loads of information throughout the tournament about a particular matchup or a particular scenario or a rule that you the scenery rules, how they actually affect the game, because some packs are very different to other packs. So you can think something, but then seeing it in practice can often be different. So the data that you have, it could be wrong just because you don't have experience into that particular pack. So sometimes don't be afraid to adapt. Don't be too formulaic.
You want to have some flexibility in that. I mean, this is all very, again, using our sport analogy, just because sports have been doing it for decades, but obviously they've got very set plans how they want to play, but obviously there needs to be a bit of flex if things don't go quite how they thought they would, or if they go just how they thought they would, there has to be a bit of flex, right? So,
yeah.
Fascinating. Right. Biggest mistake or a top tip from each of you, please. So, Darren, if we start with you, biggest mistakes or a tip you find for pairings, team building that you want the listeners to go away with?
Don't be arguing. Don't be arguing. You don't know how emboldening that is. If I see a couple of people having, you know, slightly, there's that weird thing where you're trying to whisper so your opponents can't hear you, but you're also super animated because you really want to make your point and you can't do it with a loud voice, you know, so just communicate put a bit of thought into how you're going to communicate before you go to the pairings, because large gesticulations embolden your opponents.
Great. Absolutely great. Laurie, biggest mistake or a tip that you'd like the listeners to go away with?
I think a tip is, it's quite a hard one, I think. Well, one that I've struggled with is, don't brag too much before the games are finished about how well the pairings go, if they've gone well for you. Because I find that really hard. Like, when it's pairings gone well for me, I want to immediately go, fucking hell, chaps, we got 6 out of 8 greens. And all you're doing there is just heaping a whole lot of pressure on your team. So that's
the opposite. I slap the table and like, come on, let's go. We've got them.
Well, it depends again on context, doesn't it? But like, I remember if you remember, Darren, the Scotland matchup, we had we were matching into not a human being, but JP Gannis's app he'd created purposely for this.
Oh yeah, interesting. Yeah.
I mean, so this was AI that we were dealing with, and we came away
screwed
from that.
Then.
Exactly. It came away from that, and I remember. I think we got 6 or 7 greens. It went well for us in our head. And then Luke Morton very helpfully told us that, according to JP's process, they were up by 15 points on that round. And he messaged that in the team in the chat. I was like, oh, cheers, Luke. That's really, really helpful of you to share that.
Yeah.
Share the information for us all. And so there, I just, the feeling was that on paper, or on terms of the matchup matrix, things have gone well for us. I think the feeling was that these weren't easy wins. There are a few there which, whilst were green, were maybe not the greenest green. There's a Blackadder joke there, isn't there?
They weren't
the purest green. And so I think me going around going, Jesus Christ, I smashed that, lads. You better pretty well follow up. I don't think would have been helpful, actually. I take your point, Darren, that if actually you want to buoy up your team, then certainly that's a tool to use. But if you feel like you've got a whole lot of close games going to be going on, and you're going around like the Cox pajamas, whatever, then yeah, that's not helpful.
It doesn't make you end up being liked very much either.
No.
Fair enough.
The whole AI matchup and how green is green, how red is red, is that's for me personally, that's super interesting going forward and how that might change things. Owen, biggest mistake or a tip?
I can't stop thinking about how the Scottish software is going to be like, AI, we're using AI.
I don't know why. I was the one that did bad accents.
No, that was great. Come on. There's been a murder.
Been a murder with the AI. Yeah.
Sorry. Mine is more of a teams-based tip. A tip for the teams out there. Anyone wanting to start
teams. Tips for the teams. Yeah.
Get yourself some shirts and maybe some dice if you fancy. Because,
or some socks.
Socks even. Because you look around and you've got your teammates there, your brothers and sisters in battle, and you're all bedecked in some kind of awful vest or something, perhaps. Sorry, maybe team.
Oh, shots
team.
Fired.
That was. I swear that wasn't there a team that had shirts and they all had pictures of you on as well, Laurie?
That was me.
That was you.
That's happened. That's now happened 3 times. Which...
You're very photogenic.
Yeah.
Well. This is odd. Once was Team Keen had vest tops with all of our pictures on, so that's understandable. And then Darren's done it, and then at the recent Bucklers Invitational, they all had pictures of me on. I wasn't even there.
You're just in their heads, Laurie. You're rent free in their minds.
Oh, you know what we're going to have to do now? We're going to have to do Let's Go Wild socks. my point is, get some shirts made, even if it's just some iron-on transfers with the name and stuff, because it's a memento and it's nice to look around. And
I would say, like, you're right, if you can get cheap shirts, great. But the more recent ones we've got for my local team, we've only just started playing like as a proper team, are those kind of quite basic level ones. They are very hot. They are very sweaty. So I would, when you're producing the team lit ones are designed by the head of a year 10 GCSE IT team. But they are very, very easy to wear. They're very thin and very, sports material. So that's what I would say, is that if you are getting yourself some t-shirts, then maybe get some nice ones which won't make you sweat about 100 degrees.
Yes. I've got a tip there. Another tip is OYO is the sort of the esports jerseys. I think it's what a lot of the international teams use, and that's what we use. They have a 3D designer thing online, and you can put your own logo on there.
Oh, yeah, I've seen these before, yeah.
Yeah, that was what that, because obviously I'm the chief drip manager for the Welsh team.
That's your official title, chief drip manager.
Chief drip manager, creative director, and drip distributor.
I'll await the spinny necklaces to come through, Owen, for your next Sigmar team.
Soon. Anyway, yeah, that's my slightly silly, but...
I think that's perfect, because if you're uncomfortable and you're hot and sweaty, you're not going to play as well, are you? Psychologically, playing any game, if you're uncomfortable. Yeah.
And dice and gauges and all that jazz. It's like, it's a team, right? You know, you want to feel like a team.
Yeah, perfect. Fantastic. Right, to our final section. Darren, I don't want you to wake up everyone in the house, but please take it away.
The misplays.
Oh, lovely. That's lovely.
That was great.
Lovely, Darren. Thank you very much. Thanks.
Oh, I feel 10% sexier doing that.
We're going to have you with misplays, Owen with matrices. I mean, it's going to turn into an ASMR podcast.
I was going to say ASMR is sort of Age of Sigmar. ASMR, right?
Ooh, beautiful, Owen.
Should we do something there?
I think we're doing ASMR mini episode.
And you can do that, the Disney joke again about he's coming or it's coming.
I'm so excited. Right. And what I am excited for is the misplays. So for those of you who listened to our last episode, you will know that we had, and as I mentioned at the start of this episode, we had some fantastic responses for the misplays. My favourites being Ming's railroading his army, but Craig Danvar's forgetting a whole turn was obviously excellent. And we've had even more amazing replies and responses to your misplays. So thank you very much for sending those in. So if we go around, we've all each got a few or one, I think. So Darren, do you want to kick us off?
I'll do one of my own and then one of Tom. I think it's Parry. It's Tom Paz 1984. On Twitter, but I'll start with my own. I lost a game once against Dan Ford that I'd already won. Livid. It was, I can't remember the scenario, I'm sure Owen remembers it. You both had three objectives in your deployment, and the longer you kept them, they were worth more. So they were worth 1 point if you burnt them at the end of the turn. They were worth 4 points if you burnt them from turns three to four onwards, and they were worth eight, a massive eight, if you managed to keep them for five turns. You know, so it wasn't just having them on turn five, it was having them for five consecutive turns and then burning them. And I managed to play Dan Ford, and it was incredibly tough because he had this army of undead, and it was just, you know, it's a typical Dan Ford list. It was like 40 skeletons, 40 skeletons, 40 skeletons. He had like 15 Black Knights, and they had another unit of 10 Black Knights that were off board and could come on. So it's just grindy as hell. And I was using old Seraphon. But I managed to feed him units and keep him in his own deployment, and I was doing ever so well. And then I went for this one big play that I'd engineered from the very beginning. So I was super pleased with it. I got saved up all my summoning points. I teleported my two units, because it was back in the days when Seraphon could teleport two units, across all the way to the side of the board. And then I made this big unit of 40 skinks at the time. I made them be able to fly. And because he'd set up in lines, it meant that I could jump over and I could weather. I put so many skinks on his objective, and I managed to grab one of his objectives that I didn't think I was going to be able to do. And I burnt it straight away before he could reply. Now, at that point in the game, it was turn four. I could have burnt that one for a point, but I could have also burnt my one on the left and the center one. And a lot of my army was buggered. It was all castled around this other one. And I'd forgot that he had these units that could come on from off board. He had like 10 Black Knights ready to do so. So I should have, at that point, I'd won the game, because I could have burnt that objective for 4 points, the other one for 4 points, and had 9 points, castled around my last objective, which he could not have gotten for 8 points. So I'd have ended up on 17 points, and he'd have burnt his two and only been able to get 16. So at that point, I'd won the game. But then He looked at me. He was waiting for me to say that, and I never said it. And with glee, he said, "Right, my turn."
I can see his face now.
Yeah, you've never played. I doubt you've ever played. Oh, if you haven't played Dan Ford, he's absolutely lovely. But he's got these big, big, yes, deep, bald eyes. It's like he microdoses. That's the. You know, and I'm sure that's not the case. I'm sure
I think he's in bomb disposal. So I
hope he works in a nuclear power plant.
There you go. Man. I hope he doesn't look close.
He can tell you some scary stories about how you can die. Let me tell you from nuclear particles. But anyway, that's another conversation. But yeah, so he took his turn. He just wandered on the board. Took my it did require him to win a priority into turn five because he came on. You know, I had set up some screens, but it wasn't sufficient. It wasn't sufficient defense. So I lost. And it was at the Masters, and all our game was a little bit over time, like 2 or 3 minutes. So every other potential master was surrounded around me. So it's the worst time to make a fuck up like that, is having an audience of people that, you know, you're potentially going to have to play later. So well done, Dan, for keeping Sturm and beating me in the end. But that was my losing a game that you've already won. That's a pretty big doozy, isn't it?
Yeah.
Darren, just very quickly, for completion's sake, I think the mission was Better Part of Valor.
Thanks, Owen.
You're welcome.
And then Tom Parry, bless him. I've been at an event, I think it was Bobo before. You know how John likes to talk throughout the rounds? I remember day two, Tom was pissed out of his head and he would just kept talking very loudly to me whilst John was trying to do the announcement. It was hilarious. Good man, Tom. His misplay here is he once took his chameleon skinks off the board turn three to redeploy them next turn. Forgetting that, of course, they die because they need to be on the they can't be, if they're off the table after turn three.
So he just took them off to die. Yeah, it's good.
He just took them off and they died. Yeah, brilliant.
And I really like these ones.
It's a Seraphon one.
Yeah, I really like these ones. This is sort of a theme for my ones that I've got. But Laurie, any misplays?
I think Darren's obviously shared one of my classes.
I don't remember that one at all.
Yeah, that one. I don't remember if Darren shared my final position was I fell to the floor and scattered dice across the hall. Such an abject misery. But another excellent, turns out, as you said earlier, Alex, we've all got many more misplays than we have plays. Another excellent misplay, I was playing Craig, previously mentioned Craig, top table. Game five, blood and glory. Basically, whoever win would at least podium, probably take first place. And this was like 100 mana or so. It was on blood and glory, the old scenario, blood and glory, where if you took all four, then you'd win. The thing with blood and glory was, and maybe you'll remember it from back in the day, is that whenever you got to turn two, you always had to remember that, you know, turn three, you could win. Because it wasn't end of turn three. It was at any point during turn three, if you controlled all four, you'd win. So you really had to play turn two, thinking about turn three. I won priority because it was a close game. I had my Winterleaf list and he was running the old Gav Bomb Evocators list. And really close game. And I won the priority into two. I was like, right, I really need to consolidate here. Taking a bit of a bashing. Need to get myself back into a good position. Played a pretty solid turn. Cleared quite a lot of stuff. Finished my turn. Said, all right, your turn. And then looked at the board and went, oh, fuck. If he wins priority into three, he wins. Just, and then he played. And he hadn't twigged. Craig hadn't twigged. Played the entirety of turn two. And he pushed stuff around. And I was just sat there, kind of biting my lip like, shit, yes, still doesn't realize. Old priority, I lost priority, and he carries on playing. He starts moving models around like, oh, fucking hell, maybe I'm gonna get
right. He doesn't know. Yeah.
And then he moves one unit, and then he moves another and goes, wait, I've won, haven't I? And I go, yeah. And this is like, and 40 minutes earlier, I think I texted in the Sylvan F chat or something like that and gone, yeah, I fucking lost this. And then 40 minutes later, Craig finally goes, yeah, I've won, haven't I? I was like, yeah. And then we shook hands. And this was, I'm not sure if I said, but this was on Warhammer TV back in the days when Warhammer TV covered independent events as well as their own events. And you had, I think it was Nick Baton and someone else commenting over there, and they cut away from us. And then I remember kind of clenching myself into a little fetal ball and shouting, fuck! And if you watch the commentary back, you could just see them go, okay, and we had a good game. And they both just paused. hear me yelling that. Because I just realized how I'd thrown that away so comprehensively. Because I still had like 50 drives in Alario left, but I just left a gap for him to get onto my objective. So yeah, that was impressive. And I then in more recent times did it again with Lurkers Below just two tournaments ago. So yeah, learning from mistakes, clearly.
Always. I'd love to find that footage of them commentating. I bet it's quite an Alan Partridge moment for them. I'd love to find that footage.
Yeah, me too.
Amazing. Thanks, Laurie. Owen.
Oh, well, I fuck up all the time. So it's too numerous. So I don't have a standout. But I do want to mention one that we got sent in, which is another. There's a lot, like you say, Alex, there's a lot of kind of, it seems like, null deploying or keeping things off the board is a bit of a trap.
Or, yeah, it feels like that, doesn't it?
You know what I mean?
Sent in. Yeah.
There's a very famous picture. I think it's actually a 40K picture where there's a guy with
this
40K,
yeah.
Yeah, and he's kind of, yeah, everyone's seen that picture. So, yeah. Anyway, I think a tip, I know it's not the right section, but perhaps have a token or maybe some kind of little mascot or something to remind you about your stuff off the board. I think Nurglings off the board and have to come on turn one. How many times have you played against someone playing Nurgle and you're like, yeah, go on, just drop them somewhere next to some terrain. It's fine. I don't mind. But yes, I wanted to mention this because I really like Joe. I've never got to play Joe. I think it's Grzynski from one of the Justice series guys.
He's
I really like.
Yeah.
Yeah. Lovely guy. And he's messaged in to say he left what equates to a quarter of his army off the board. So two units of Blood Knights and a unit of zombies in reserve on a super cagey game of the Vice. Game 3 at the Justice Series GT last year. Suddenly turn 4 and my opponent informs me one quarter of my army is now destroyed. I mean, I wouldn't want to be that guy, but at the same time, you know, if you're playing in a competitive game, then you would, you know, that feeling when you're like, he's fucking forgotten, isn't he? Oh my God, he's forgotten. We're into the shooting phase. This is glorious. But yeah, so hard luck, Joe. But I'm sure you had a big smile on your face
Absolutely. Thanks, Joe. And as you say, the amount of people, I mean, never bloody happens to me when I'm playing someone, but the amount of people that sent me messages saying they forget and they destroy stuff with it not coming down. Maybe my top tip is, token or get something, anything, paper, anything to help you remember that half your army is going to about to be destroyed in a turn.
Maybe just don't have any crutches and just put it all on the fucking board and use the movement phase instead. How about that?
I think
go on, Barry.
Sorry, now that you're playing Sylvanifer, and I don't think you can be quite as salty about crutches anymore. Think, now you're not on a gash bear. You've got
beasts.
Yeah, and beasts as well.
Heresy. I don't know what you're talking about.
Mine. So again, there were so many to choose from. So apologies if we didn't get around to all of them. We will keep doing these because they're fantastic. One sent in from Jack Davenport at J Davenport is your Twitter handle. Jack says, I deployed my bone splitters out of range to deny my Skaven opponent a turn of shooting, which sounds great. But then he then used his pre-game move to move himself back into range and then gave his opponent the first turn and then got shot off, which I think is fantastic, Jack. Thank you very much for sending that in. Please don't do that in the future. Don't move your whole army back into range after keeping them out of range. And then a similar one, let's see if I can find it, back from Mikey Wendell. I like this one because I think there's also an autocorrect in there, which is absolutely amazing. And I'm going to read it out as the autocorrect. So Mikey or Mix says, I picked Desecrate Panda as my battle tactic against Lumineth. As I controlled the piece of terrain from the previous turn, I moved off it to chase another unit And then at the end of the shooting phase, a fox flies back onto it and steals it. And they lose the battle tactic, which I think is A, great because foxes, and B, the fact you put a pick desecrate commander, which has then led to a whole new Twitter thread about basically people winding him up about pandas, with Peter Pratt saying, I bet you couldn't bear it. And yes, it had you bamboozled. So which is great. So yes, so thank you for that. Any others, gents, or should we call it there?
No, I'm grand. They were grand.
We're all good. Fine. Fantastic. So again, yes, thank you everyone, and again thank you to all of our lovely followers. We will get those socks soon and we'll let you know. The next few episodes, depending on scheduling, we've got a few in the pipeline, but they'll revolve around, we've got one on sportsmanship, one on psychology, which I can't wait to do, and one to talk about playing on stream, and also one about some weird tome that's coming out at some point. We'll do something about that. So please do keep stay in touch with us. We'll get around to those episodes. But all that's left for me to say is thank you very much, Laurie. Thank you for coming along.
Cheers, guys. Thanks for having me.
Yes, thank you.
Thanks, Laurie.
Thanks, Darren. Thanks, Owen.
Thanks, lovely.
And for all the listeners, do keep sending your questions in and your misplays. We love reading them. We love reading them out, even the piss-taking ones. So be kind, look after each other, and we'll catch you all next time. So cheers. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.